finding fulfillment at any age.
I wanted the stories all to reflect the lives of people who had not achieved prior success, who had no great means to acquire success, but who after 60 found their idea and their passion.
That's Bruce Frankel. We talked to him about his book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? Later in the show, we talk with psychologist Susan Whitborn about her book, The Search for Fulfillment, revolutionary new research that reveals the secret to long-term happiness. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Okay, I'm going to get personal here. I'm kind of a late bloomer. I didn't figure out until I was in my early 50s that what I really wanted to be was a journalist. It's not like I came to journalism with no preparation. It's just that I never knew that that's what I was preparing for. I learned how to interview by being a clinical social worker. I learned how to get a point across in hopefully an engaging way by being a teacher. I learned about issues by being an activist on the environment, labor, and peace. Even being a massage therapist helped because I learned how to pay attention to all the cues coming my way and digging deep. I've always been interested in a whole lot of different things, and journalism is perfectly suited to indulging that passion. I guess I'm not alone in setting out in a totally new direction late in life. Bruce Frankel did the same thing, as we'll soon hear. But his wonderful book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life, isn't about him. It's about a host of unforgettable, everyday people he interviewed who found fulfillment, happiness, and a measure of success in following their passion after the age of 60. Sometimes the passion wasn't new, just the success. Like the writer who finally got a book published at age 94. After writing 40 unpublished novels. Other times, the passion was new, like the former intelligence officer who became a modern dancer in his mid-50s and continues to dance professionally in his 70s. Bruce Frankel got the idea for the book when he faced his own professional crossroads in life. Let's listen. Bruce Frankel, welcome to Writer's Voice. You're a writer, you're a reporter, you've written about other things, not this before you wrote this book. What got you interested in adults who decide to change their lives and do something quite different in the second half of their lives?
Well, actually, my own life really was the door that opened the way to this. I had, as you said, worked as a reporter for most of my life in the last part for USA Today and People magazine. And I left working full-time as a journalist at the age of 51 to fulfill my own passion to go back to school and get an MFA in poetry at Sarah Lawrence College. And when I got done with that program, I had assumed that I would get a job as a teaching poetry and English. And I miscalculated a bit how my life went after that point, and things kind of fell apart in terms of my marriage and my life, and I found myself suddenly needing to find work. And one day I was having lunch with a close friend of mine, another writer, who was turning 60 that week, and he had had a project blow up on him, and he had written several books, but he was also facing questions about what he was going to do to recover his life and how he was going to make a living at age 60 as a writer. Many of us who worked in newspapers and magazines found our world falling away. So we sat over long four glasses of water at a cheap sushi joint. And on my long walk home, I kept turning over ideas, trying to come up with something that the two of us could collaborate on. And by the time I got home, I had this brainstorm that we would write a book together, collaborate on a book about people who achieved significant success after 60, and we would thus become successful. It was somewhat whimsical. My friend Jim was dubious of whether we could find the people, and he eventually got another book to write and did well with it. And I was kind of stuck with my own idea.
Yeah, you say people after 60. You start off your book with somebody who achieved success as a writer at the age of 94. Tell us about him.
Well, that's Harry Bernstein, who I adore. And Harry has actually turned 100 at the end of May. And Harry had worked his entire life as a writer, really. He published his first short stories in the late 1920s. He came from Chicago to New York, but he could never really make a dime at his short stories. They were published in little magazines next to people like Nelson Algren and William Carlos Williams and Gertrude Stein, but he could never make a dime. They were proletarian journals. He ended up working the end of his career as a editor for a construction trade magazine and retired to Brick, New Jersey. He had a great wife named Ruby, who he adored, and they lived in a quiet, comfortable life in a bungalow in New Jersey until Ruby passed away. She was just 90, I believe, or around there. And it was the first time in Harry's life that he had ever lived alone. And in a way to escape his pain, he began to write. First, he wrote a piece for Newsweek magazine that got taken by them. And then he sat down and, to get away from his pain, wrote about his life in England before World War I.
Harry had an incredibly brutal upbringing. Tell us about some of that. Tell us about the experiences that he had to overcome and the resilience that he had.
Well, Harry had phenomenal resilience. I mean, he did, as you said, have brutal childhood. His father was a brutal man who was an alcoholic and brutalized his mother and stole money, and yet his mother could not leave him. And Harry also suffered through the Depression. And when he met Ruby, his life changed, as he says. I mean, he found not just the love of his life, he found a woman who supported him as he wrote novels. He wrote 40 novels that were rejected over time, but he kept writing. He destroyed most of them, sadly. But at any rate, after Ruby passed away and he began writing, he found for the first time his true voice in a way. He started at 95, 94, and the book was first rejected by everyone in the United States, but accepted by Random House in England at 97.
And why do you think he found his voice? What was it about that story?
I think that he learned the lesson that all writers eventually learn, which is write what you know. He had written other things that he thought he knew, but they were imaginative. And when he wrote about the life that he had actually lived and was unafraid to write about the brutality of it and the odd beauty of it, I think that everything flowed naturally, as he would tell you, that he doesn't really work very hard at his writing. He thinks it, he lays in bed and dreams it, and then he gets up and writes it.
And he really seems to be a lesson in tenacity.
He's remarkable. I mean, I went to Harry's birthday party a few weeks ago for his 100th birthday. He had been a little ill before and been in bed for a few weeks at his daughter's house, but he got out and came to the birthday party, was in a wheelchair, and he had just completed his fourth book in 5 years. And I spoke to him on the phone last week, and he told me he had launched his writing a fifth book now. So
it's phenomenal. Another really phenomenal person, and they all were, actually. All the stories in your book are just, the stories are great. They're well written. I have to congratulate you on that. But the people themselves really make the story also. But I was fascinated with the story of Naomi Wiltick, who is the proprietor, the owner, the manager of, is it the world's
Erotic.
It's the World Erotic Art Museum. Is it the only one or major one of its kind?
It is. There's now another one, not exactly like it, in Las Vegas. There's an erotic art museum in New York, but it's not very good in comparison. And there's one in Paris. But Naomi's story is marvelous. I mean, she's a great character in many, many ways. She was the one person, and I should say thank you for your kind comments about my writing, but the truth is that you're right. The stories, the people are the story. And I tried to put my writing at the service of the stories, which was easy to do because they were great. But at any rate, Naomi was married to Ziggy Wilczek, who was a Holocaust survivor and an amazingly successful banker in New Jersey. He was a very powerful man. He was a founder, one of the co-founders of the Holocaust Museum in Washington. He was also a very vain man, and he really was the tyrant of the family. And Naomi, at one point, she was always trying to lose weight because he wanted a perfect woman, a perfect body. And so she was always going off to other diets and spas and so forth. And one day she was at a spa and she came across a magazine that had a listing for a nudist colony in it. And she pursued that. And that was the beginning of Naomi's liberation from her past, from her husband, and the discovery of something that it would eventually lead to the discovery of erotic art.
And she was not a wild and crazy character before this.
No, she wasn't. And as she will quickly tell you, she missed the sexual revolution entirely. She grew up in an Orthodox family where there weren't graven images. She read about the sexual revolution in the newspaper, the magazines was about as close as she ever got to it. And she was a mainstay in her synagogue in New Jersey. And she did not live a roaring life. And I think that Naomi would actually tell you too, even her venture into nudism was really an act of liberation, in which she discovered that a way in which she could exist without being defined by the money that surrounded her, being judged for who she was and what she knew.
Or even how she looked.
And certainly how she looked. I mean, I think she really came to see that people look all kinds of ways, and there are very few perfect bodies in this world, and she didn't have to live in that prison. And I loved her story. At one point, I was wondered whether I would use her story, because I wanted the stories all to reflect the lives of people who had not achieved prior success, who had no great means to acquire success, but who after 60 found their idea and their passion. I decided, despite her wealth, to use Naomi's story, because I felt that she overcame so many hurdles in achieving this. And because, like the other people in the book, what she achieves is not monetary, but it's a vision, and it has a mission attached to it, which in her case, she now speaks to classes on human sexuality. Professors have her all the time. She's made herself into an expert on the subject. And so she's come an awful long way from the childhood and the marriage she had to a person who has a great breadth of knowledge about human sexuality and how it has been represented through the course of human history in art.
And she came to it in a kind of very typical way for a woman of her kind, as a good Yiddish mama?
Absolutely. I mean, Naomi, you know, she was sitting at home one day and she got a phone call from one of her sons, who is a pretty interesting character himself, Sir Ivan. He's a former banker, now rock musician. And he called and asked his mom, knowing that she had started down a life of nudity to some degree, if she would get him some erotic art. But she didn't have any idea what erotic art was. She had to ask him, what is it? I don't know what it is. And he tried to explain, and it took her more than a year of, she used to antique, she would go to antique stores, and she couldn't get up the nerve to ask if people had erotic art. And finally, she did one day, at the tag end of asking for porcelain or china that she was looking for, she let slip that she was also interested in erotic art. And much to her delight and the dismay of the owner of the store, they actually had a piece which they had secreted away, which became the great lesson for her, is this stuff was all around, but you had to know how to ask and be trusted to ask for it.
It's a wonderful story. And we're talking with Bruce Frankel. His book is What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? True Stories of Finding Success, Passion, and New Meaning in the Second Half of Life. Another story that I found also personally very interesting to me, because my mother is a dancer and choreographer, and her last performance at Lincoln Center was when she was 83 years old. She'll be turning 90 this week. And you talk about a dancer named Thomas Dwyer. And unlike my mother, who actually has been a dancer all her life, he started when he was in his 50s. Tell us about him and how he got into being a dancer. It's really a marvelous tale that you tell there in your book, and you obviously are quite impressed with this man.
Well, I've fallen in love with so many of the people in my book. I have relationships now with all of them there. I admire them greatly and adore them. But Thomas came to me, I learned about Thomas, I should say. I had started a relationship of my own a few years after my marriage fell apart with a woman I had known in my boyhood, and she was a dancer and had been a dancer her entire life. And I said to her one day, there couldn't possibly be a dancer. No one starts dance in late in life. That just doesn't happen, right? And she thought, and she said, no, actually, I know of a couple of possibilities for you. And she put me in touch with the Liz Lerman Dance Exchange, which is in Maryland on the edge of Washington. And there was a dancer there named Thomas Dwyer. And I went down to see Thomas. And Thomas's story is, as you say, quite remarkable. Thomas had been in U.S. intelligence service, probably the CIA, though that will never get confirmed, for his entire life, practically, from his 20s, certainly. He was a telecommunications specialist and often worked in back channels for embassies all over the world, particularly in the Far East. And he had retired in his 50s, come to Washington, didn't know what he was going to do, thought about opening a detective agency, took painting lessons, and then one day saw his elder brother in a elder dance performance and saw the look on kids' faces as they watched and said, this is what I want to do. I want to do this. I want to show young people that you don't have to just sit in a rocking chair. And he began to take dance lessons at the Liz Lerman Dance Exchange or work with classes there. And he had no skill. He had never taken a dance class. He had not been athletic. He was your proverbial 95-pound weakling when he was a kid. His family was shocked when he said, this is what I want to do. He had none of the attributes of a dancer. But he worked at it. And Liz Lerman will tell you that she loves Thomas, particularly because he worked so hard to overcome the physical issues that he had to overcome to become a dancer. And now he still dances.
At the age of
75, and he's still a principal dancer, and he's got a wonderful presence on stage. He'll never look like a ballet dancer, but that really isn't the point of dance in the Liz Lerman world anyway. But it's, he has, when Thomas comes on stage to dance, everyone's head turns to watch Thomas.
Say some more about Liz Lerman and her project. Tell us what it's called, and it includes both professional and unprofessional dancers.
That's right. Liz Lerman was herself a dancer and choreographer, and many years ago, and she's now a MacArthur fellow, and her mother became ill with cancer about 25 years ago, maybe more. I can't quite remember. After her mother died, she wanted to choreograph a dance about her mother. And she needed elder dancers to do it. And so she began working at a home for elderly, and she saw these people who were just sitting around and not doing anything, and no one thought they could do anything. And she began to work with them and play music and get them to dance. And lo and behold, of course, what has been observed elsewhere since, put music on and people, something sparks in people. They came to life. Many of them learned dance. And she came up with this idea then, I guess really now, it's probably 30 years ago, of creating an intergenerational dance company in which young trained dancers would dance with older dancers, those who were older dancers who had danced in their lives, and those who had never danced before. Because Liz had this notion of the body being able to express somehow more if it's not so refined in its movements. And so they have a very interesting methodology of arriving at the actual dance movements, where a, as they call them, youngin, will do a dance move, and then the elder dancer will do the same move. Now that move, because the body has its own history, will be changed. And then the youngin will reflect that change. And back and forth they go, editing the dance until they have a structure within which they can all work together. And it's quite remarkable. And they tell stories, of course, too.
What was interesting to me, and this is something I also saw in my mother, you know, as she aged. Well, for example, when she was 76, the Village Voice named her as Dance Pick of the Year. Her name is Frances Alenikoff. But nonetheless, at 76, and even more so at 83, which was after her first big fall, when she had broken her leg, you know, her movements were quite different, but she had a different kind of power. And you notice the same thing in Thomas Dwyer.
Yeah, absolutely. Thomas, of course, worked very hard. He was also, when he was younger, was not, as I said, not an athlete. And even in his later years, when he decided that he was going to become a dancer, he began a very strict regimen of training his body physically. And he still does, like 2 hours of warm-up before the day begins. And young dancers, when they see him in workshops in colleges and universities, are agog at what Thomas puts himself through. He can do countless push-ups. And in one of Liz Lerman's dance programs, Genome, which looks at the history of DNA and discovery of it, and Thomas plays the part at one point in the dance of someone who has been genetically programmed so he can't die even though he is aged. And he undertakes to commit suicide by doing so many push-ups. And when they were rehearsing that, they had to stop Thomas because the audience would get too bored. They cut him off at 45 push-ups with his legs up on a chair because he could have gone on forever.
So now let's turn to some other of the characters in your book, real people, however. You actually do a kind of twofer, and that is a story of Alidra Sol Day and Granny D, another story of amazing persistence, really on both their parts. Tell us who they are.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, they're both great, great stories. Granny D recently passed away this year. She was a woman from New Hampshire who she was 89 when she met with a group of other women up there, and they came across the issues of political reform that were needed. And they discovered a bill that had been pushed through Congress in the middle of the night, and thanks to the help of lobbyists, and she became furious and wanted to do something to awaken the American public to the issue of political reform that was required, to the need for campaign finance reform. So she decided, one day she was on vacation with her son in Florida, and she saw a man walking along the side of the road, quite by chance. And she said, I have an idea. I'm going to walk across the country, and I'm going to make myself basically a banner for campaign finance reform, and I'm going to do this. And her son said, well, you can't, that's not possible. And she began to train herself in New Hampshire, walking longer distances each day until she was ready. And she started out in Pasadena and walked across the country. And in fact, she became a beacon for campaign finance reform, and authors of the bills all met her when she finally entered Washington, and she was probably as responsible as anyone for helping draw attention to the issues. Aledra Soldé, a few years after Granny D had walked across America, Aledra had been a psychotherapist in New York City. And she had suffered a great deal of illness. She had had breast cancer, and she had a lot of heartache, too. Her relationship of many years broke up during that period of time, and she didn't know whether she would survive. And while she was on vacation in California, and this is really, it's kind of typical of the way in which many people find their passion. It's unanticipated. Something comes across their field of vision that strikes them, and they have a kind of aha moment without even really knowing it's an aha moment. So she thought to herself as she was sketching and drawing mountains out in California, you know, what I really want to do with the rest of my life is when I come back in the next life, I want to be a filmmaker. But I'm too old for that. There's no way I can do that at this stage, and it costs so much money. And she began to work in a class with other people that was geared to helping people figure out if they only had 1 year to live, what would they do? And she eventually summoned the courage to take a rudimentary class in filmmaking, just learning how to use a camera. And from that, she began to explore it. And her first notion was to do something along the lines of what I did, do a story about older people who succeeded. And she came across the story of Granny D. And that took her roughly about 4 years to complete for a variety of reasons, and took an enormous amount of will and strength to do so.
Yeah, in fact, she had some real pushback because she wasn't a professional filmmaker. She didn't have all those credentials behind her name, yet she finally succeeded anyway, put herself considerably in debt, I guess, at a certain point, or had spent a considerable amount of her money, of her own personal money, and it went on to be an award winner.
That's right. The story is remarkable because she risked so much in order to do this film, and she did have pushback. She was seen as an amateur by the people around Granny D. They didn't know what to make of her. She was so persistent and was doing the job of a filmmaker, but they didn't trust that the product would end up being anything. They didn't know that what she was. So at one point, she backed off, in fact, because she was getting such resistance, and she went to a Zen center in California where she tried to regroup her life. And at this point, she had already spent so much of her money that she had hoped that she would use one day for retirement. She was in a difficult situation. But she realized again that she couldn't let this project drop, that she had too much invested in it. And she went back at it. And she had the help of a couple of friends who put up a little additional money, but also a professor with whom she had studied at NYU, who saw a cut of her work and thought what she was doing was so great. Even he went out and got some money for her. And she spent a couple of more years and made the film, and then it was sold to PBS in New Hampshire, and eventually I think something like 45 stations around the country, and it won prestigious awards.
Bruce Frankel talking about his book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? We'll talk more after a break. Stay tuned.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Oh, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine. shine. It's still a light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine. Oh, 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 oh,
welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Bruce Frankel about people who change their lives after the age of 60, go into new professions, follow new passions, and do so successfully. I told him a little of my own history as a late-blooming journalist and how I felt that my previous careers had given me some skills that I might not have been able to get in journalism school.
One of the things that I think happens when people fasten on an idea late in life is that all of their experience and all of their intelligences pour into that, funnel into that in the service of what they become committed to and passionate about. They've learned skills that you don't learn when you're 20 years old or when you're in school. Ted Levitsik, who is the sculptor in the book, who was a contact lens grinder for most of his life, and then discovered after he'd retired from the field of contact lens grinding, one day had built a seawall next to his little property in Havistraw, New York. He had spent a year building this wall, and it looked blank to him, and he, at that moment, he looked down in the water, and there was a stone that he picked up and had this desire to chisel a face on. And he went to his garage and got a hammer and a broken lawnmower blade to use as a chisel and carved a face and plastered it to the wall. And the next day, Ted returned to admire his handiwork. And when he looked at the wall, he thought the face would look joyful, and yet he felt it looked sad because it was alone. And he felt it needed a companion. So off he went in search of another stone, which he carved. And now, you know, almost 20 years later, there are 1,700 heads, and some of the heads are quite large in proportion. The property is called the Easter Island on the Hudson now. And he has evolved into an amazing sculptor over these years. Is collected by numerous museums, in particular the Visionary Museum in Baltimore. But, you know, that's one of those cases in which Ted couldn't have told you that he was going to become a sculptor. He didn't know that that path was ahead of him, and he couldn't have told you that he had the skills, though they were there because he had trained his hands and his sensibilities over time.
For you, you're a baby boomer. You were in your 50s when you started this. As you are going into now these later decades of your life, what was the greatest lesson, personal lesson, of this book and the people that you met through it for you?
Working on this book and coming to know these people utterly changed my life. It changed my sense of timeline. I am 60. I turned 60 on January 2nd. And when I left Time Inc. at the age of 51, I thought my life was closing down in a way at that point, and I didn't really know what was left to do or what possibilities would present themselves to me. And what I learned in interviewing these people and being with them was not to really think about age. They don't think about age. They don't talk about their age. They talk about what they want to do next. They live their lives, as I say, forward. They don't live in regret or rumination about what they could have done, should have done. It just is not part of their mentality. And I think that that really is the key. They focus on what they are doing and what they want to accomplish. And so they're living towards something, always. And, you know, that has been an enormous lesson to me. If things go wrong in my day, I don't sit around and think about what I could have done differently. I think about what I can do next, how I'm going to make the next chapter happen, the next word happen, whatever it is.
Bruce Frankel, your wonderful book and inspiring book, What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life? Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate the opportunity.
In addition to What Should I Do with the Rest of My Life, Bruce Frankel co-authored the New York Times bestseller, World War II, History's Greatest Conflict in Pictures. Before going out on his own as a writer, he was a reporter for USA Today and People magazine. Next up, how to become fulfilled.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to...
Susan Whitborn has been following the same group of people around for 40 years. No, she's not a stalker. She's a psychology professor at UMass Amherst. And what she's been studying is how some people find fulfillment in life while others never seem to get it together. Or still others remain too fearful to take the risks that might bring them happiness. Whitborn's distilled what she's found into different pathways people take, which ones to avoid or leave behind, and which ones lead to fulfillment. It all started out in the 1970s when Whitborn got interested in following up on a study someone else had done on college students 10 years before. She found most of the original group, asked them about their lives, and compared the answers with the original study. She also added another group for comparison. And she thought she was done. But she wasn't.
And then I thought, okay, that was a great study. We published it. We were done. And then about 10 years after that, one of my very good friends in the field of aging said, so, Susan, you ready to do your next follow-up? And I said, well, I hadn't really planned to do it. I thought I'd proved my point. But that planted the seed, and I thought, you know, I really should do this. And, of course, at that point I was completely hooked and wouldn't think of anything else other than following this sample. The Search for Fulfillment, which is the name of the book, has also been my search for fulfillment in carrying out the study.
So you referred to your favorite theory. Is this Erik Erikson's theory of development?
That's right. Erik's psychosocial theory, which many people learn about, because I think it captures the essence of development and change over time in a way that no other theory that I know of does.
So let's go into this theory a little bit, because it is interesting. I'm sure many people have heard about it. And how does it also compare to Abraham Maslow's theory of development? It seems that they're both really talking about the development of character, of personality, of growth throughout the lifetime. Is that correct?
Maslow talks about self-actualization, which is a process that is more likely to be realized in people who are in maturity in their 40s and 50s and 60s, but he doesn't go through developmental progressions. Erikson really charts out the whole lifespan from birth to death. He talks about 8 different issues that each of us confront, typically at particular ages, but they can occur at all different ages, which is another thing I found in my study. So they are really different. And Erikson isn't as interested in that state of self-realization as transcending all else. He's really interested in what you would get to maybe towards the middle and end of your life would be an integration of everything that you've gone through before.
And what you've gone through before, let's talk about some of these issues, some of these stages. Let's start with the very first one, trust versus mistrust.
Okay, the bedrock of personality, though it's something that can come at any time in your life, but trust is a sense that others in your environment are caring for you, are going to be supportive of you, that you have nothing to fear from harsh treatment by your environment. Mistrust is basic cynicism. One thing that I found with trust was that it was really important for helping buffer people through major challenges or very difficult, stressful events that occur to them in the time of the study. So I had some people who I call on the triumphant trail who had really gone through horrible events, just unimaginable personal losses. But looking back at how they were able to do so well at the present time, it was because they had really high scores on the trust dimension.
Now, this is something that's developed, I think, between birth and two, although, as you say, these are not necessarily chronological. One of the questions I had with this was, you know, the case of children who grow up in extremely difficult, even abusive environments, who seem to have a real natural resilience. Sometimes it may be because at a certain point later in their life, as children, they may find a trustworthy adult. Maybe not. How would you explain that kind of a difference? You know, a child who doesn't get that basic trust in the beginning but seems to be able to develop it.
It is possible to make up for earlier losses later in life. One of the things I found in the study, too, was that people were able to catch up with their peers who maybe exceeded them on some of the measures in the study. So it is possible to make up for those earlier deficits. It's difficult. And I just was at a conference recently where someone was presenting data showing what the effect of a harsh environment is on, this is in studying mice, offspring, how it changes your RNA, your, you know, basic sort of genetic, you know, protein reproduction. And it does make it more difficult even at the, you know, sort of molecular level. But people do, and it's hard, and it takes an exceptional amount of support.
Okay, so let's move on here. Then there's the development of autonomy versus shame and doubt.
Okay. Well, it's typically thought of as the toilet training stage. But, of course, Erikson rewrote all of Freud's stages, and that was the time of the terrible twos. And Erikson thought that children at that age want to express their independence. But if they're made to feel that they can't trust themselves, so it goes back to the first stage, then they're unsure and they're inhibited and they are always questioning and wondering about themselves, and they might be either too dependent or they might be just have a real difficulty connecting to people.
Then there's initiative versus guilt.
That's one of my favorite stages because it involves playfulness, initiative. Sounds like, oh, you know, I want to go out and do a lot of things and be successful, but that's not what Erikson meant. He really meant it's just kind of having fun and feeling that you can explore and play. So it is really the preschool age of play. Some people call it openness to experience, which also turns out to be extremely important for personality. Just being able to let your flight of ideas, let yourself use your imagination. And then if you're not able to do that, then you feel inhibited, you are very reluctant to express to yourself, you're scared of looking stupid.
How much might this also be determined by genetics to a certain degree? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of risk-taking. You know, there are people who, you know, they can be pretty entrepreneurial types and kind of go where other people are afraid to go. So how much could some of these be genetic and not just social?
What a great question, Francesca. I am not a genetics person. I'm on the nurture side, but obviously,
nurture versus nature.
Yeah, I'm on the nurture side, but obviously there are interactions. However, the amount of variance in behavior that can be attributed to genetics is very, very small, something like 0.04%. It's tiny. It's been exaggerated by studies that have had some problems in their methodology, and really when you have enough data over the aggregate, you see that it's a tiny, tiny percent that true genetics can explain behavior.
My goodness, that's a huge area that one could actually go into, because isn't genetics so much of what's behind the idea that, you know, if we can find the right drugs and tweak people as opposed to psychotherapy?
Sadly, we're not going to be able to find those genes very easily. When they map the whole human genome and they go and try to attribute behavioral behavior to these specific gene combinations, they come up short. Even with schizophrenia, which there was a lot of hopefulness about back in the not that long ago, but it's just not working out the way they thought it would.
So there's more of a role for psychotherapy than perhaps than has been thought maybe over the last 20 to 30 years.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of evidence from psychotherapy that it works, and a lot of evidence that just taking medications isn't going to be the answer either. Now, in my book, I talk about ways that people can change and can benefit from therapy to get on the right pathway. And so if you're on a pathway that isn't leading where you wanted it to go, I wouldn't say go to a psychiatrist and get 5 or 6 prescriptions to get you back on the pathway. There are steps that you can take that are psychological in nature to help you move your pathway in the right direction.
And we're talking with Dr. Susan Whitborn. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and has just written a book, The Search for Fulfillment. There are a number of other stages that I'd actually like to get to by talking about some of these pathways, because they're kind of the later stages of development. And since you focus on adults here and adults that you've followed for the last 40 years, you really are talking about those later stages of development in your book. So you identify 5 pathways. Tell us just very briefly, kind of give us a Cliff Notes version of those pathways.
The first 3 are the ones that you would rather not be on, and the last 2 are definitely the more fulfilling. So the first pathway, which is the meandering way, includes people who have not come to a good sense of their own identity. They're kind of flailing around, going from one set of commitments to another, one job, one relationship, one type of education, one town, you know, one city, one country. They're going all over the place, and they never stay there in one long enough to be able to experience fulfillment. And in this pathway, they seem to think that life will go on forever and they can just keep experimenting. But of course, life doesn't go on forever. So eventually, by the time they come to my study, they're not doing very well because they feel like time is running out, which it is.
And just stop right there, because before we go on to some of the other pathways, I'd like to ask you about that. Here on the show, Writer's Voice, a couple of years ago, we interviewed Margaret Lobenstein, who's written a book called Renaissance People, which very much does describe folks like this, people who have gone from one career to another career, people whose interests are pretty varied, and, you know, they may have a number of different careers going on at the same time, or more likely it's kind of a serial careerism. And she says, you know, that's a particular kind of a person who's not very valued in our society, but that's a social judgment, and that in fact these are risk takers. These are people who have many varied interests. They in fact may have a very strong sense of ego identity. They want to follow wherever life experience may take them.
I think that's absolutely true. And the 5th pathway, the authentic road, are definitely people who have branched out in many directions serially or at the same time. The key with the meandering way, and I really am so glad you asked that question, because I want to emphasize that I didn't engage in judgments about whether I thought these people were successful or not. I really don't do that. I'm objective about it in that sense. I just looked at what they said. And when they said they were currently very unhappy and they'd been unhappy somewhat chronically, then that to me is what differentiates them from the Renaissance person that you're speaking of. I mean, you might go through a period where you're unhappy until you find your niche, or maybe it only lasts for 3 or 4 years. But the advantage of a 40-year study is that you get to see, are they ever happy? You know, have they ever felt fulfilled? And that was pretty big criterion for me in having them show up on the meandering way.
So this is really based on people's own sense of themselves.
Absolutely. These are the answers they gave to the questions that I asked them.
Okay. Second pathway.
Okay. Secondly is the exact opposite. So this is the pathway called the straight and narrow pathway. And the reason it's on the negative side is because they're not happy with the way their lives have gone, and they've been very static, been in the same job, the same relationship, the same community. They might be following the designs that their parents had for them And you could tell that because they were actually doing the same things that their parents were doing in some cases. So I call it the straight and narrow pathway because they didn't look to the right or to the left. They just kept plowing ahead without making significant changes, and they were not happy. So when I start describing the pathway, I said, well, you know, it's the person that you always thought you would like to be if you've had a kind of up and down life. Oh, if only I could be like this friend of mine who I get their holiday letters every year and they're doing the same thing they always did and you can really set your watch by them. Why can't I be that person? Well, it's not necessarily the ideal sort of life pathway. It can be, but these were the people who were very unhappy because I think they just were afraid to look to the right or the left. I think that for whatever reason, they had inhibited themselves from doing so.
So you're, in a way, it sounds like you're really describing authenticity.
Yes, they did not feel they were leading the authentic life.
So I know we're skipping ahead a bit, but tell us about the authentic road.
Okay. Authentic road, and again, this is over time, they might not always have been happy, but at the point that I reached them in their late 50s, they felt that the changes they had made prior to then had brought them in touch with who they really were, their authentic self. These are the people who did feel that the twists and turns that their life had taken had gotten them to a point where they were fulfilled.
Well, so here's a point where, you know, society versus the individual can come in to be really problematic because with the authentic road, I mean, we live in a society which values certain things far more over others, and often authenticity is not one of them. Value, unless to be authentic is to be rich and famous, let's say. You know, so there may be certain professions or successes defined in a very particular way, in kind of a narrow way in our society. So did you find people who were on the authentic road who had to struggle with feeling that, yes, they were following the path that they needed to, but it was kind of against that resistance of society?
No, because there was another pathway where that happened. But the people on the authentic road felt in tune with society's values, and I'm sure there were many times when they felt discouraged, and even at times that I caught them, because, you know, I catch them at glimpses over the 40 years. I'm not, you know, following them, and they don't have little, you know, some studies have these little beepers, and they say, okay, tell me your mood right now. So I didn't do that. But at the times when I caught them, when I did ask them to reflect about themselves and take some time in answering the questions, they were satisfied with their life, whatever it had been. Now, I also had a lot of other data about them from what they told me about their jobs and their family situations, and I also was able to find out information about them, and sort of in the process of tracking them down, it would turn out I learned this and this and this about them, which amplified what I knew from the questionnaires. So they weren't necessarily making a lot of money. I had people making a lot of money who were miserable and felt that they'd sold out. And those were the people, some of the people on the downward slope. You look at those people, and I just couldn't believe when I'd open up their questionnaires and I'd say, what's going on? Have I miscounted this? You know, did I put a 5 instead of a 2 when I put down the answers? I went and I checked, I double-checked, triple-checked. No, some very successful people who really felt their lives were empty. They felt success had come too late for them. That was really sad. Some people who had seemed to be fulfilling their lifelong dream who were regretting that they didn't get this earlier. But on the authentic road, people internally felt they were fulfilled.
Yeah, and I think that wasn't so much what I was saying was more that people, you know, such people could feel internally fulfilled, but that they were aware that they had had to resist. For example, let's say somebody who decides to become a meditator, you know, they live very, very simply. They are really devoting themselves to a spiritual path that they feel is right to themselves. On the other hand, every time they talk to their mom or dad, you know, they're saying like, well, so when are you going to get that job? Or, you know, I now have a nice little girl for you. You know.
Well, there's a person in the book on the Authentic Road who fits that description very well. And it was a person who definitely went against the norms. I think I said in there of her, her name was Loretta, that her parents were probably pretty upset because her salary was less than her yearly tuition had been. And so she didn't bother her at all. She and it, maybe it was partly the way I was asking the questions, because I was asking the questions about your inner fulfillment. Mm-hmm. I wasn't asking, do your parents give you a lot of grief? You know, does your family make fun of you? No, in fact, I have an imaginary encounter between her and somebody on the straight and narrow pathway, and she's looking at the straight and narrow guy going, oh my gosh, you know, this poor person, I'm so glad I'm not him. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a lot of inner directedness that keeps them going, and they might look around and, you know, just look at other people and say they've missed the point.
We're talking with Susan Whitborn about her book, The Search for Fulfillment, Revolutionary New Research that Reveals the Secret to Long-Term Happiness. So as we're talking here about happiness, ultimately, and you are talking about people who are reporting their own feelings of fulfillment, I found some of the most interesting parts of the book is the one about legacy, the legacy pathway. Talk to us about that. Tell us.
I actually originally was thinking of calling the book something about finding your legacy, but then it sounded like one of those retirement fund books that I really didn't want to have. I preferred the term fulfillment. But legacy was very important to me. And in the book I talk about, well, you can have all sorts of legacies. You can have a legacy that's very bad. We can think of some heinous people in history who have legacies. So the kind of legacy we'd like to think will contribute to fulfillment is a positive contribution to the world. Leaving of yourself behind for others to remember you by, but not intentionally engaging in that behavior. If you start to think, I'm going to do this so I'll be remembered, it kind of defeats the purpose. So it's really going into it without a lot of self-consciousness about, I have to do this so I'm remembered, and finding out maybe some way later, just randomly, that you had accomplished this. I'm thinking of cases where, as a professor, you know, we all get emails from former students, and every once in a while I get an email from a student saying, oh, you know, this course really made a difference, or thank you so much for that recommendation because now I'm doing this. And, of course, on Facebook I keep up with a lot of my former students. And I think that those of us who are have those experiences, know what it feels like, that we have made a difference in somebody's life. And it could be one person, five people, 25, 20,000, 20 million. It's just the sense that there's something you've done that made the world a better place.
Susan Whitborn. Her book is The Search for Fulfillment, Revolutionary New Research that Reveals the Secret to Long-Term Happiness. Whitborn teaches psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.